Dada! Dada! Olé, Blas, pa' ser cristiano. Gracias, Pastor Noel.
We realize our consciousness is affected. There is this thing going on, what is called
the news, brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is June 14th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyankahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back with some news on 90.3 FM.
The people's sound is calling. The Suwanee Perry Popolo Music Festival is back and online with free jazz, noise, punk, new music, spoken word, electronic, avant-rock, sound art, and dance parties. Over 60 artists performing from Montreal, Chicago, Philadelphia, Sioux Lookout, Toronto, Mexico City, Brussels, Berlin, Tehran, Kampala, and Nairobi. Heed the call between June 3rd and 21st at suwanneeperrypopolo.org.
Did you get vaccinated?
Not yet, but I will soon.
And which one are you getting?
I'm getting the dance vaccine.
The dance vaccine? Great idea.
Yeah, rehearsing with the girls is what I miss the most.
Well, it's going to be the soccer vaccine for me. I can't wait to see the gang again.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
First, news. Quebec's Minister of Health and Social Services announced this week that Quebecers can move up their second dose appointments for the AstraZeneca and Moderna vaccines. Minister Christian Dubé says the required wait time between the first and second dose of the vaccine is now 8 weeks, not 16 weeks. COVID numbers in Quebec continue to fall, and the province has not reported a COVID-related death in the last 3 days. And a new research organization called the Observatory of Black Communities in Quebec launched on June 14th. Its goal is to study the effects of anti-black racism and propose solutions. Edouard Stako, president of the Black Youth Socioeconomic Development Summit, says that the many projects in black communities need more information to boost their impact. And organizers canceled the Montreal Marathon due to the ongoing health restrictions. The marathon first took place in 2019 and was scheduled for September 24th to the 26th of this year. Organizers say that the runners can get refunds on their tickets or use them again next year. A federal court rejected a motion to suspend the deportation of Jatinder Singh on June 11th. Solidarity Across Borders, SAB, has been advocating for the cancellation of Singh's deportation since May. They say it is dangerous and unethical to force him to return to his home country of India, which has been hard hit by the pandemic. SAB is also calling for the release for another detainee whose pseudonym is Melina. They say officers in the Laval Detention Center harassed her and withheld food from her. And a video of a Montreal police officer kneeling on a young black man's neck to arrest him circulated on social media this week. The encounter happened on June 10th near a high school in the Villeray borough. Mayor Valerie Plante called the incident quote-unquote worrying and said body cameras must be mandatory in the Montreal police force. City dwellers accused the Montreal police of using excessive force in April after one officer was filmed punching a man in the head while his colleagues held the man down.
Fabies and Mr. Blue invites you to a barbecue on Saint-Jean-Baptiste Day, Thursday, June 24th, from noon to 9 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park in Côte-des-Neiges, corner of Côte St. Catherine and Westbury. Weather permitting, come out and enjoy. On the menu, doubles, roti, jerk pork and chicken, curry goat and chicken. Lots of side dishes. Wear your mask, social distancing required. That's Thursday, June 24th, noon to 9 p.m. at Mackenzie King Park in Côte-des-Neiges. For more information, call 514-771-7011.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Brian Jefferson. On this episode of Off the Hour, we'll tune into a podcast from the show From Embers. Make sure to stick with us till the end of the hour. We'll give you some news you can use right here in Montreal on 90.3 FM.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Today on For Members, we're featuring an interview with Nathan Munn, who is a freelance journalist based in Montreal. Nathan has written several investigative pieces for Vice over the past several years, looking at the hub model of policing, which has been quietly rolled out across the country, and especially in Saskatchewan and Ontario over the past 5 years or so. The hub model is a so-called soft policing strategy and can be called a branch of community policing. And if you want to learn more about community policing in North America, I would recommend an article by Christian Williams called The Other Side of the Coin. And that article looks at the history of community policing in the United States and places it in the context of counterinsurgency theory and repression. I think the hub model is an important development in the Canadian political landscape. While it's still a relatively new model, there are over 100 operating hubs across Canada. And Ottawa and Toronto recently announced plans to introduce citywide hubs, also known as situation tables, to address an ever-expanding number of targeted behaviors, ranging from skipping school to political radicalization to social disorder. I really enjoyed my conversation with Nathan, who's done a lot of work to expose a lot of issues with the hub model. He's dug into the data behind it. He's asked serious questions about individual privacy, community profiling, and state control, as well as following the money through the nexus of government agencies, university researchers, and private consultants who are pushing this model across the country and getting wealthy in the process. You should check out our show notes for links to Nathan's articles and more information on the subjects we're discussing today. As always, we're always interested in getting listener feedback and ideas for future episodes. You can email us at fromembers@riseup.net to get in touch. Look us up on your favorite podcast app, search for From Embers, or tune into CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. This is our interview with Nathan Munn. How did you get interested in the topic of community policing and hub models and all that kind of stuff? How did you get onto the topic?
I really wanted to get into journalism. I've always been huge into journalism, the form of it, and I've read a ton of it since I was a kid, but I'm not trained in it at all. I didn't go to school for it. So I was kind of poking around, figuring out how one becomes a journalist coming in from the outside. And it really started when, I guess it was back around 2014, that's when they first started rolling out armored police vehicles in cities kind of across Canada. And I'm from Ottawa originally, and I read a news article where it was police responding to something like a break-in or something. It wasn't nothing particularly dramatic, but they had, in a picture for the article, they had rolled out this armored tank style, you know, and I was just kind of blown away by that. I was really creeped out by it. So I started digging around to see if I could find out where the money was coming from to pay for these things, because I assumed that normal budget processes, that people wouldn't be voting to pay for these things to have in cities. So started digging around, long story short, and I found a story about that, but I didn't end up publishing that. And what I did find was the first document I found related to situation tables, which is Ontario's version of the hub. And as soon as I saw the word situation table and how it was described in this budget document, I was just kind of intrigued. I was like, oh, that sounds sketchy, and it sounds it sounds like there's some rights violations going on there. And sure enough, when I started to dig a little further, I was really stunned by what I found, and it was just like this completely different approach to policing, kind of transforming police from a service that are to be there when you call them into a kind of an entity that monitors the population through these civilian agencies like hospitals and doctors and social workers and everybody else who's involved. And I saw it immediately as an extension of police power rather than a softening of police power. And so I got really interested and I started digging. And I guess about a year later, by then I had published a couple articles with Vice already on different stories. And that's when I started pitching the first story about the hub. And it took a while for me to really clarify what I thought the problem was. And then once I provided a bunch of information, they were like, yeah, okay. And that's when I published the first one in 2017. And then I've been investigating them ever since. And the more you dig, the more you find is what I've found.
Yeah, I've been reading through all the articles over the years, and I'd like to get into kind of the evolution of the program, but perhaps we should start with the first model, which was in Prince Albert, and I guess it was based on a program in Glasgow, Scotland. Can you speak a little bit about that?
The hub model is an approach to policing that partners police with civilian agencies, so doctors, social workers, bylaw officers, school boards, all this kind of civilian social infrastructure. So the Glasgow model, Glasgow is one of the most violent cities in Europe, and it still is today, as I understand. But there was a huge epidemic of knife crime going on back in the mid-2000s kind of thing. And so they came up with this model where police would proactively come to people's houses that they were concerned about, houses where there was known to be, violent activity happening or has happened nearby, and nothing criminal per se, but associated with elements of criminal activity, possibly. So the police would go and knock on people's doors and kind of say, hey, look, we're here to help. If you need any access to social services, please let us know. And anecdotal evidence showed that it was pretty effective, that a lot of people were choosing to take police up on this offer and to get out of the kind of life of street crime and street violence that I guess is a big part of the culture in Glasgow. So based on that, two individuals from here in Canada, one who was the chief of police for Prince Albert at the time, and Prince Albert is a pretty small city in Saskatchewan, and they deal with a lot of violent crime issues. I'm sure some people are aware that all the prairies, like North Prairies, there tends to be a lot of problems with violent crime and crime in general. So the police chief of Prince Albert got together with a longtime colleague of his who is he's an independent kind of consultant guy, but he's been training chiefs of police. He's been the program director for the chiefs of police education program for a long time. And anyway, these two got together, they went over, took a trip to Glasgow, learned what they could about the model and brought it back and decided to launch it in Prince Albert and see how it goes. And it's a massive change for how policing is done in North America and Canada, in the sense that we have strong privacy laws here, and very siloed, social services. The reason that the privacy laws are so strong and that our agencies work so closely within their own silos is specifically to avoid the issues that I think the hub model raises, which is the building of databases that collect information on people from all sectors of society. So yeah, they implemented this in Prince Albert. And so what they would do, just to give an example, for example, say police get called on a disturbance call. And they show up and there's nothing criminal happening, but say there's someone who's, mouthing off at their neighbor or something like that. Normally, police would be powerless to do anything about it if it's non-criminal. They would just say, okay, well, keep it down, off they go. But under the hub model, what they're allowed to do, they've often referred to it as a, quote, whole of government approach. So the hub, and this is how it happened in Prince Albert, too, is that they would meet once a week or twice a week. And you'd have people from all these different agencies there, health and doctors and social workers and cops, they would all get together and they would begin to share information about people. And they use what they call the four filter process, where they, at first, they do it anonymously. So they'll say, you know, we have a male, looks like has problems with addiction, maybe problems with drinking. We've responded to a few calls. We can't really do anything to help. Does this sound like something that we could all, that we could approach this problem from a more multi-sectoral approach, is what they call it. And if everybody around the table agrees, then they start to share more information. They say, okay, well, turns out this person lives on this street and blah, blah, blah. They share a bit more. And then they, in order for a case to progress through a hub, they have to meet what is defined as acutely elevated level of risk. Now, this isn't a legal term. It isn't a legal concept. It's a subjective concept that any hub can come up with on their own. So if someone says, well, it looks like this person has likely has a problem with drinking, there might possibly be a mental health issue, and the person is unemployed, each one of those represents what they call a risk factor. And so if everybody around this hub table agrees, oh, this person has enough risk factors that they're heading for crisis. They're going to be in big trouble soon. So at that point, what all hubs are allowed to do, and this applies to all hubs across Canada now, at that point, they can deploy an intervention and send police to a person's house to quote-unquote offer services, which is to come up and say, look, we think you have a whole bunch of problems. We think you need to go, would you like access to mental health services or whatever? And again, and, you know, you hear this and it's like, I understand that the intentions are good. I don't think that this is a, you know, this is an attempt to attack people. It's a very misguided attempt to help people is what I think it is. A lot of the program literature asks the professionals involved in this to try and gain consent wherever they can. But if they can't get consent and they think a person is in big trouble, then they can send out these interventions. And through the investigations that I've done over the years, I've found, and it's really hard to find information about what happens with these interventions, but I've found a couple documents that show that some people have been forced into hospital as a result. Some people have gone to jail. In the most literal sense, the hub model, as it started in Prince Albert, represented an expansion of police powers under the guise of it being a progressive approach, and they started citing numbers after they launched the Prince Albert Hub. They said, you know, violent crime has fallen by 25% in the months since we launched it. But these are totally, and this is, when I say this, this is backed up by professional criminologists who say the same thing. They say there's no hard evidence at all that the Hub model prevents crime, prevents victimization, or save lives. There's zero hard evidence. All there is anecdotal evidence, and they've been relying on this anecdotal evidence for years to spread this program across the country. And it's in my opinion, it's shocking how credulous provincial officials have been saying, yeah, this sounds great. And they've been implementing it and rolling it out with zero foresight to what some of the negative consequences could be.
And so just so we can kind of picture what a hub actually is, like, I understand it's a 90-minute meeting twice a week involving several different agencies. Which are some of the agencies that are involved and why are they at the table?
The most common configuration for hubs is police, health services. So that would be hospital boards, local healthcare networks, social services. Children's aid, you'd have children's aid there for sure, in almost all of them. And then you'd have a bunch of others like boys and girls clubs, bylaw officers. And there's quite a few others, and it actually varies from every city and every county, that has a hub or a situation table, as they're called in Ontario. Each one is its own unique configuration, but generally those are the elements that are involved. Housing agencies as well. And then you'll have, those are like the primary members, and then you'll have a kind of a secondary circle of members that can include like staff from women's shelters, homeless shelters, more frontline, less less like highly professional when you're talking about, you know, hospital boards and stuff like that. And then you've got this more frontline, like, yeah, shelter workers and stuff. And they typically don't have the same amount of power as the primary members do. But yeah, exactly. It's a meeting. So it's literally a great big table where you've got 15 or 20 people seated around it. School boards actually is a very important one to mention. School boards are involved in nearly every hub. So, and a school administrator can bring a problematic kid to the table and say, you know, we have a student, they've been missing a lot of school. We think they might be hanging around with the wrong crowd. We think they need an intervention, basically. And then so if everyone agrees that it sounds like a risky situation, then they progress through the filters of sharing information up until they decide who's going to do the intervention. And one of the most worrying things, in my opinion, is that how they gauge people's risk levels, the risk factors they use to apply to people. So if someone is unemployed, someone has a known drinking problem, someone has been the victim of an assault, things like that, this is the kind of information that they base these decisions off of and say, oh, this person, you know, normally a police officer or a healthcare worker would never know, they would never know anything beyond what the person is telling them. So someone shows up at the hospital, they're drunk, they have a broken arm, you know, that information is put into the hospital database and it's left at that. But through hubs, everything is shared through this process. So it can come to the point where you've got a bunch of professionals sitting at the table saying, okay, this guy showed up to the hospital a couple times last month drunk. We know he's unemployed. We know he has trouble paying his rent because we have housing services here at the table. We also know that he has a criminal record for dealing marijuana because the police are here. So and what you're doing is profiling. You're building a giant profile of an individual to decide how much intervention they need from the state. And that's a huge problem. The gigantic spaces available for mistakes and for bias and plenty of other errors of judgment and all this stuff can take place. And they're judging people. Some of the risk factors they pass on people include negative behavior, which is totally undefined. It's a subjective thing. And the way they define it is they said someone who shows obnoxious or disruptive behavior. Once you get into that, you start profiling people on things that you could never profile them on before, like tattoos. If somebody gets Thug Life tattooed on their stomach, I think that sounds like pretty negative behavior through the eyes of a social worker or through the eyes of a healthcare professional or a police officer. You know what I mean? In Toronto, in 2018, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it's something in the area of 600 plus individuals and 500 plus families were subject, like entire families were subject to assessment for intervention, and something like well over 500 people and families were subject to interventions in Toronto last year. And that's just Toronto. And no one is cataloging this. No one, I mean, the only reason I know that is because the United Way is involved and they're keeping track of the numbers, but they don't track what the outcomes of those interventions are. So nobody knows how many of those people went to jail, how many of them got forcibly put into the hospital based on things like suspected mental health concerns. Ottawa is the first city in Canada to completely adopt the hub model across the board. So previously there was a hub in just one neighborhood in the city. In Toronto, there's three or four in different neighborhoods. Ottawa is the first to go citywide. So they've launched the full citywide hub program called Merit. And one of the main things that they are policing, and I mean literally policing, is antisocial behavior, which is defined the same way as negative behavior in the hub system. And that's so, you know, we're talking about things like swearing, you know, talking about things like people acting aggressively, but without being aggressive, without committing a crime. Brenda McPhail from the Canadian Civil Liberties Association, who I spoke to in my most recent investigation into Ottawa's hub model, she put it really well when she said, the program, what it does is it sets a really low bar for having someone investigated by the police. So, for example, you could call, if you saw someone behaving in a way that you believed was antisocial or negative, like, you know, strutting down the street, maybe they swore at somebody or something, or maybe they're playing loud music, or maybe they're smoking a spliff on the street.
Or maybe I'm a racist and, you know, I don't like how someone wears their pants.
Precisely. So anyone can take their own subjective bias and apply it and call the police and say, and they encourage this. There's an active page on the Merit Ottawa website that says, have you seen anyone behaving in an antisocial way? You may wish to contact a community police officer. You're taking non-criminal behavior and you're roping that into the area where police can act. So whereas police before, if they got a call about someone being antisocial, they'd shrug their shoulders and say, well, it's not a criminal act. There's nothing we could do. Now it's, oh, we'll head on down there and we'll check it out. And we all know that encounters with the police, especially for marginal communities and people of color, far more often, far more likely to end in violence, to end in unnecessary arrest, and to provoke civilians. And it's dangerous. It's really, really dangerous.
Yeah, and just to be clear, when defining risk under this model, like, they're not talking about root causes of inequality or poverty or any, like, they're very focused on specific behaviors that they call risk that are tied to criminality in their eyes, correct?
Precisely. That's exactly what it is that there's a real, in my opinion, a real false projection of a progressive nature of these things. So, yes, they're focused strictly on behaviors. And there's a criminologist from the University of Western Ontario named Dr. Laura Huey. She's also the director of the Canadian Society for Evidence-Based Policing. And she regularly calls out a lot of the issues with hubs. And she pointed out that, like, it's not like there's any extra funding or any extra attention being put into addressing the root causes of crime, like inequality and like lack of access to services and all these things. There's no resources being put towards that. What there is a reconfiguring of the existing systems to focus on people's behavior as a representation of those root causes. You know, another thing that they'll say is a risk factor for individuals is hanging out with, quote, negative peers. So you're hanging out with people that the police and authorities are saying are negative people. Well, you shouldn't hang out with those people. They're very negative. They're going to lead you down the wrong path, you know. And it's like, hold on a second, because in conjunction with risk factors, the hub model also uses what they call protective factors. So say you have a loving family, well, then that counterbalances some of your risk. They take that into account when they're deciding whether to do an intervention. But something else that they use as a supposed protective factor is that you have a positive relationship with law enforcement or that you trust the police. It's like plenty of people in this world have every reason not to trust the police. Every day the police behave in ways that give us reasons not to trust them. And that's not to say that all cops are bad or that everything the cops do is bad, because that's not true. We also need something at least akin to police. But to think that everyone should have a positive relationship with law enforcement, that if they don't, they're somehow at risk of being a negative person, like, it gets into the realm of the absurd. And as soon as you start digging into these terms and digging into the definitions they provide, that's when you see how ridiculous it is. And it's so easy to flip right back on them. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, a positive relationship with law enforcement. Are police more likely to suffer mental health and post-traumatic stress? I imagine they would be. So I would also don't think it's that big of a stretch to think that hanging out with a whole bunch of cops all the time might be a negative influence on your thinking. You know what I mean? Once you start defining people by who they hang out with, by where they hang out, that's another risk factor they apply. That you check it out. Could you imagine how insane it is to be told that you live in a negative neighborhood? That's what hubs do. Every hub in this country has a factor where it can say, this person, well, they live in a negative neighborhood. I think that's a risk factor against them. That makes me so upset, because it's like, man, by that definition, I grew up in a negative neighborhood. I grew up in a low-income neighborhood. I was surrounded by negativity on all sides. That doesn't mean that I am at risk of becoming a criminal. It doesn't predispose me to behaving in a way that is detrimental to society. In fact, often the opposite, you know? People, some of the most prolific and profound, fantastic individuals that you've ever met in your life have come out of difficult circumstances. Hubs are kind of divided into two two processes. There's the front end process, which is what we've been talking about, police and public health and people working together to assess humans. Then you've got a database that they're building called the risk-driven tracking database. And this is a database where they put anonymous information about the people they assess for intervention. They pile it all into a great big database. So this database contains a ton of information about people without their names, without their identifying information, but even that can be, people can be identified through it with enough effort. It contains all this information about people saying, you know, this person's been a victim of an assault and they have a conviction for drug dealing and whatever. But another thing that they do with this is, it shows the age ranges of people who've been assessed by Hubs. And in 2017, in Ontario, the number one most prevalent age group in the Hub tracking database was young people aged 12 to 17. I mean, we're talking about teenagers. Like, of course teenagers are behaving foolishly. You've got young people behaving in ways that young people have behaved since time immemorial. They've always behaved in ways that push the envelope and that, you know, make some people uncomfortable. But that doesn't mean that they're in trouble. That doesn't mean that they're going to become hardcore criminals. You know what I mean? But that's what, I mean, they're treating it that way, where they're showing up at kids' houses, banging on the door, and the cops saying, hey, it's just a friendly visit. We're really worried about you. We think that you're involved in... It's like, what kind of trust are these kids going to have in the system when they recognize that they've been under surveillance this whole time? I think once we really get up to where Hubs are at now, it's starting to drift into moral policing, in my belief. That's what I see it as. It makes me so upset. And I have kids, man, and that's why I do this. That's why I can't stop thinking about Hubs, is because I don't want my kids to grow up in a world where it's normal that the cops show up and knock on your door and say, you know, we've been monitoring your activity for the past year, and we've talked to your teachers, and we've talked to your doctor, and we've talked to your guidance counselor, who maybe you were supposed to be having conversations in confidence with, and we've really developed a picture of you, and we think you're on a path to risk.
Yeah, when I was reading about this stuff, I was reflecting on, like, a time in my own life when I was in grade probably 4 or 5, and I had a teacher come up to me and take me aside and tell me that I was hanging out with the wrong people. And I was trying to reflect on why she did that or thought that. And I think it's just that I was hanging out with people who weren't getting, like, my grades were slightly better than theirs, and, you know, they're skateboarders, and she had certain stereotypes about them and how they would turn out in the future. And I can only imagine how that would have gone if there had been, you know, a mental health professional and a police officer and a guidance counselor all knocking on the door and talking to me with my parents or something around that time.
Totally, man. Totally. That's exactly the issue. That's exactly the problem. I mean, all of our social services and public services, they do exchange information, and they always have in one way or another. But those provisions to share information were always subject not only to provincial privacy law, but also to the norms and standards that were considered appropriate at the time. And that's what's really changing here, is that Hubs, the entire premise of Hubs can only exist because of one thing, and that's a very small clause inside provincial privacy laws that says if there's a probability of harm, if a public health professional believes that there's a probability of harm, for example, if a guidance counselor has a kid who seems really suicidal, you know, and keeps talking about, oh, I want to kill myself, blah, blah, blah. They can say if a probability of harm exists, at that point, you can share information about the person without their consent. But what Hubs do is take that little loophole, that little exception, and they turn it into policy. They say, no, we're going to use that exception thinking. We're going to apply it to everything. So that means if you live in a negative neighborhood, well, that's one step towards a probability of harm, and on and on and on, to build these profiles of people and then to decide when they hit that limit. Think about what's really happening here. A cop and a guidance counselor and a mental health worker are showing up at someone's door unannounced, no consent, show up. Hi, we're really worried about you. Can we come in for a chat? First of all, that's terrifying. Cops scare the shit out of people. I don't care what anybody says. There's a good reason that people fear police, and that's because police have the right to detain you and put you away, and they have the right to use force. And so when a 17-year-old kid or a 12-year-old kid or a 6-year-old kid, Hub interventions have been performed on kids as young as 6 years old, by the way. If one of these kids has to deal with the full power of the state showing up and telling them, you're on the wrong path, you're doing the wrong thing, we want to help you. All it does is set them up with the mindset that I'm screwed up. In 2014, the Attorney General of Ontario fully embraced the hub model and started pumping money into spreading it throughout Ontario. That's why there's a minimum of 65, I think, in Ontario right now, and a minimum of 100 across Canada. But all those were launched through this kind of back-channel funding through special grants to police. Yasir Naqvi said that the hub model addresses not only crime, but that it addresses, quote, social disorder. And that's where we get into the real crux of what the real problem is with these things, is it's about cleansing out the elements of society that are perceived to be disorderly, that are perceived to be unappealing. That's very, very different from criminal. This isn't about rooting out criminals. This is about rooting out behavior, as far as I can tell. And the further I dig into it, I only see more and more proof of that.
Stop them from shimmering away. On white sidewalk, glittering asphalt, somewhere, summer days. The wrong way kids were something more than friends. Navigating a sprawl without end. Did you ever want to take bad advice? Did you ever want to go and take it twice? Do you remember when the world began to put up its thorny fence? Right to let go the wrong way, kids. Singing, whoa, whoa, whoa. Singing, whoa, whoa, whoa. Whoa, 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 whoa. And they call them the wrong way, kids. The kids today in the dust, with no one to look up to, because they're looking up to us. Just misfit melancholy dregs, all lost in the mob, wanderers to nowhere at all. Did you ever want to take that advice? Did you ever want to go and take it twice? Do you remember when the world began to put up right you are my friend? So what's wrong with them? Let go the wrong way, kids. Singing, whoa, 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 whoa. Singing, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yeah, I also noticed in the latest article you wrote about the MERIT program in Ottawa that the funding came from the Preventing and Countering Violent Extremism National Security Program, basically the Liberal government's answer to what to do about terrorism prevention. And I was wondering if you've actually looked into like de-radicalization centers, and because they seem to be closely related to this hub model as well, but focused more on like political ideologies that are being flagged as problematic. Have you uncovered anything about that?
As they relate to hubs, yeah. So preventing violent and countering extremism, it's a federal initiative. And so it's something that's, like you said, Liberal government's top down at the federal level. Hubs have always been a provincial initiative. They have had no federal component up to this point, but one or more of the people involved in the building the architecture of hubs behind the scenes really recognized an opportunity when they saw, hey, the federal government is looking for ways to roll out these countering violent extremism projects. They've got a bunch of money that they're pouring out, and we already have this infrastructure set up through the hub model that allows us to basically do exactly what the federal government is trying to do, which is to identify people early on in the stages of radicalization, catch up with them, and try and dissuade them from going that path. And, you know, that's an understandable goal too, right? Like, I understand, obviously, people are watching, you know, serious, real deal propaganda, ISIS stuff, and they're, you know, it's the kind of thing, yeah, if somebody's watching ISIS videos all day, of course you're going to be monitored by law enforcement, you know? And we can debate that too. That's a whole separate thing. But I'm just saying that because I understand the impetus of the government to try and get a handle on this kind of stuff. But what they do is, so both the hub in Ottawa, the Merit Program, and the ones in Toronto, which are called Focus, they both applied for that federal funding saying, hey, we can run a counter-radicalization program as part of this hub. And they both got the funds. And what that did is, because they got that money, they were able to expand from just one neighborhood to the whole city in both cases. So both Toronto and Ottawa are adopting hubs full citywide now. And yes, so, and I know that in Ottawa last year, five people went through the hub process for countering violent extremism. But what's worrying about it, in the biggest sense, is, you said it, is talking about policing ideology, right? It's not illegal in Canada to have differing political views, you know, like it's illegal to advocate for violence and to promote terrorism, I guess, now under the new terrorism laws. Of course, a lot of these things are really vaguely worded. And that's another element of hubs that is hugely dangerous, is that it doesn't have it right now in the risk factors. But I have no doubt, just from watching the progression, that, of course, political readings and ideologies and getting involved in any sort of movements, whether it's left, right, Christian, Muslim, you name it, all this stuff is coming under the radar, you know, and that's the mechanism through which it's being integrated, as far as I can see, is through the counter preventing violent extremism aspect.
Can you talk a bit about another article you wrote, outlines, you sort of followed the money for the rolling out of the hub model across Canada and some of the conflicts of interest that you found between the nonprofit organization in Saskatchewan that produces a lot of the research that justifies the model, and a for-profit agency that basically works, is hired as a consultant by police agencies to roll it out.
Yes, and this is a massive, glaring conflict of interest that the individual in question doesn't think is a conflict of interest at all, and threatened to, when I contacted him for comment on that story, he, you know, told me, I'll get my lawyers involved, and there's zero conflict of interest happening here. And then I went and talked to a couple experts, Ryerson University and Carleton University, I believe, and both of them said, yeah, this is a clear conflict of interest. It's obvious. It's like, it's not even questionable. The two guys who launched the hub model in Prince Albert, one of them was police chief, and he went on to become the deputy minister of corrections for the government of Saskatchewan. And the other guy is not involved in, he doesn't work for the public, even though he's heavily involved in public policy. He's not a public employee. He went on to launch a consultancy, a for-profit company that police departments can hire to implement the hub model. So, and it's a little bit convoluted to explain, but the crux of the conflict of interest lies in the fact that this guy who started this consultancy, who makes money off of setting up the hub model, he's also the editor-in-chief of a journal produced by a nonprofit organization launched by the ex-deputy minister in Saskatchewan, who has gone on to become, he's now the chief of police in Edmonton, actually, and he's trying to roll out the hub model across the board in Edmonton as well. Anyway, he had launched a nonprofit to advance the philosophy and the thinking and the practice of the hub model, and then his buddy launched this for-profit company who in turn sets up hubs for police departments. And so he's been making a tidy business of this for the past however many years.
There seems to be an underlying philosophy that the more data inputs that are going into these policing operations, the better. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch to think, well, why not deputize librarians and crossing guards, utility workers, whatever. The more data we have on people, the more we can predict these patterns of crime, blah, blah, blah. What role is like social media playing in these sort of data collection operations for police and their partners?
Social media plays a huge role in this. And from the very beginning, there's been problems with it too. Back in 2014, the Privacy Commissioner of Saskatchewan opened an investigation into the Prince Albert Hub. So they started an investigation based on complaints about how the hub model was operating. And the first thing they found is that the government was keeping identifiable databases with this extremely sensitive information about people and about minors. And it was fully personally identifiable. So Saskatchewan said that they destroyed the databases, and that was that. But they also noted that police and their partners were often going into social media and scanning like Facebook, trying to find information about people tied to their risk levels. People say things on social media they would never say in real life. They put song lyrics on social media. They put jokes on social media. All this stuff for a public authority to be going through someone's Facebook feed and say, oh, you know, it looks like you quoted, a Tupac lyric here. I think you're heading in the wrong direction kind of thing. And that's exactly what they were doing. You know, so they were using that in their assessments of people. And the Privacy Commissioner said they had to stop that right away. The province said they did. And that was that. But, I mean, I think we all can understand that social media is ubiquitous. So to pretend that it's not going to be leveraged as a data source, any social worker concerned about a client is probably going to poke around on social media. And I'm not saying that to disparage social workers, and I'm not saying they behave illegally. All I'm saying is that if that's your job and you have to find out information about people and how they're doing, you're going to go to available sources. And all this stuff is online, you know. So there's a huge risk there at the very least. And that's not to say it's happening right now, but a huge risk.
What kind of pushback exists against this model? I know you interviewed people from the Ottawa Black Diaspora Coalition. There's been obviously journalists and academics who have spoken out. But what kind of pushback exists now, and what do you think it would take to actually reduce the degree to which this is infiltrating our society?
It's really difficult to say, and it's because most people on the surface, I think, when they first hear about hubs, they don't see the problem. When they hear, oh, yeah, police are working more closely with doctors. See, it's funny because you can take the hub model, and if you say it a certain way, if you describe it a certain way, it sounds like a very progressive approach to policing and public health policy. If you say, you know, police are partnering with health professionals and social workers and other social services agencies to provide the help that people need when they need it. And this is the kind of language they use. It sounds so great. It sounds like, oh, this progressive thing. Oh, finally, they're getting the cops to work with doctors more. It makes so much sense. And so it takes a lot of explaining. It takes a lot of breaking down the issues. And I've gone through that process with my editors, you know, where I'll come to them with an idea, and I'm like, oh my God, look at this. And you really have to sit down and kind of lay everything out in front of you before you realize, oh, yes. There's not just one problem here. There's like 10 problems here. And there's already been a couple complaints lodged with the Ontario Privacy Commissioner, one against a school board and one against a police service related to hubs. And they say that both of those have been resolved, but the details about those can't be made public. But people are filing complaints. Academics are speaking out when given the opportunity. It seems to me that there's a bit more of a pushback building within the criminology community and the policing community. And I think there's going to be a lot more pushback moving forward because it's spreading so fast, and it spread so fast without anybody knowing. Now that it's starting to become public knowledge, and now the conversation is starting. And it's really, the conversation should have happened 8 years ago. It shouldn't be happening now. Another criminologist gave a similar analogy where she said, would Health Canada roll out a drug and just put it on the market and let everybody take it for 5 years before they ever ran a study on it? Of course not. It's crazy. You don't know what kind of harm you're doing. And it's the same thing with the hub model. And people can say it's a different case, but it's really not. Public policy has really serious impacts.
Have you heard any cases by any chance of social workers or agencies who've decided that they're not going to cooperate with the table?
It's funny you ask that. The only instance that I have confirmed is I spoke to a social worker who told me that in this person's experience, Indigenous communities within their region, and I can't say who it is because I promised them anonymity, they were very reluctant to share information with the police about people. And that may follow a pattern of general reluctance to work with the police, period, understandably, coming from the Indigenous community. That being said, there's also Indigenous communities who are very public about their support of the hub model. So it's not something that can be said across the board, but there are organizations who are very reluctant to share that information and to kind of open up the floodgates in terms of working with the police in all areas that way.
Are you still looking into this now, and what kind of work do you expect to be coming out with in the future?
Yeah, honestly, I don't plan to ever stop digging into hubs, only because I think it's one of the most significant public policy stories of the decade, and I think it's only going to keep getting more important. In terms of what's coming down the pipe, it's hard to say. I have a few Freedom of Information requests winding their way through the appeal process, but definitely what I'm trying to do is to get more real, tangible data for specific cases. Like, I'd like to know how many people were involuntarily hospitalized in a particular city due to hub interventions in a year, you know. I'd like to find out how many people went to jail. I'd like to find out how, if police have had to deal with any violent reactions to them showing up at people's houses, you know, because these are the stories that will tell us the real impact of hubs. Like, if there's plenty of people out there who are borderline disturbed, they have difficult lives. This has always been the case, you know. But if a bunch of public officials and police show up at the door and bang on their door and say, you know, confront them, basically, I have no doubt that some people are going to react poorly to that. And I want to know what happens to those people, you know. It's like, I can't think of a single person I grew up with who isn't at risk, you know, who I couldn't tick off 3, 4, 5 risk factors for, according to hubs. And hubs now, they used to talk about how, oh, no, you need 6, 7, 8 risk factors for hubs to get involved. It's not true. In Ottawa, 1 risk factor it's been reduced to. If you're truant from school, you're open to being labeled as being at acutely elevated risk and therefore eligible for non-consensual intervention by the cops. Just for skipping school. I skipped school every day for 5 years, you know? I would have been subject to that, no question. Every single person I went to high school with, same situation. So it's like, it just worries me for young people in particular. It's like, man, it's just a whole different level of state power and state involvement in the individual life that, yeah, I just think there's a whole lot of problems with it, and that's why I won't stop digging into it. I can't, you know, it's too compelling.
Yeah, actually, I didn't properly finish my story about that teacher who took me aside. Like, the thing that I thought when I thought through how that went was I was never felt more loyal to my friends than after that conversation. Like, I never felt like more like I needed to be friends with the people I was already friends with than after that experience.
That's amazing, man. And that speaks right to how young people are, you know. Young people are passionate. Young people are into their friends. Young people are discovering themselves. They don't know who they are yet, you know. So they're trying on different things. There's always been consequences, you know. Like, if you're a young person and you start dabbling in petty crime, you're going to discover consequences very soon, you know, one way or another. You're either going to get arrested or you're going to find yourself hanging out with crooks, and you're going to have to make some decisions. You know, it's naive to think that we're going to stop every kid from becoming a criminal. When they talk about, you know, negative neighborhoods and stuff like this, or hanging out at negative locations, it's like, what about the kid who hangs out at the neighborhood pool hall or whatever, or, and the pool hall is considered, oh, it's a negative place, you know, it's low income people hang out there and It's like, maybe this kid is in there teaching himself to play pool, and maybe he's going to come out of there a champion. I think of all the young people I hung out with, and we were all engaged in negative behavior, and we were all smoking pot, and we're all out at all hours of the night and whatever. But you know what we were doing too? We were learning to play music. We were learning to fall in love. Like, seriously, how can you say someone lives in a negative neighborhood when they could meet the person they fall in love with in that neighborhood? It just, it makes my brain want to explode. Like, lives change in an instant. People make decisions in an instant. And yeah, there are, sometimes those decisions end in tragedy, and that's brutal. And it's important that we have first responders there to help when these situations happen. But that doesn't mean that anyone is qualified to sit atop a society and monitor everyone and start to say, well, this one's heading down. Oh, this one's hanging out at the pool hall. This one's skateboarding. He's in a negative neighborhood and he's got Thug Life tattooed on his chest. I think we need to intervene with him. It's like, mind your own business, man. It's just appalling, because it's like, what if we go into the rich neighborhoods? Where are all the, you know, where's the white collar crime? Where are people committing fraud? Where are people running brokerage firms and investment firms that dupe people out of their pensions?
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a podcast called The Future of Policing in Canada. To hear the rest of this episode and more, it's at fromembers.libsyn.com. And before we go, here's some news that you can use. This weekend, the McCord Museum is providing free access to two exhibitions honoring National Aboriginal Day. The museum officials said the discovery of a mass grave at the former Kamloops Residential School spurred them to share these exhibitions with a wider audience. National Aboriginal Day is on Monday, June the 21st. Also in museums, the Montreal Museum of Fine Arts has a new street exhibition honoring the Arctic glaciers. It's called Adrift and integrates a recording of a poem by Innu author Josephine Bacon. The group behind the exhibition, Collective Incognito, says Adrift allows city dwellers to be carried off by a stream as formidable in nature as it is fragile. And Quebec's health ministry announced Tuesday that it will allow up to 3,500 people to gather indoors at events. These include tonight's semifinal matchup between the Habs and the Vegas Golden Knights at the Bell Centre. Each independent section of the centre will seat a maximum of 250 people. The city of Montreal is also pedestrianizing 13 streets this summer, including the LGBTQ+ village on Rue Saint-Catherine West and parts of Boulevard Saint-Laurent and Rue Wellington. These streets stretch across Montreal's 19 boroughs and will be lined with shops, bars, and restaurants. And in more summer activities, the Clock Tower Beach in Old Port is reopening this weekend. The beach overlooks the St. Lawrence River and is dotted with blue parasols and lounge chairs. Beach entry is free up until September.
You're currently listening to Spaceship, The Landing, by Montreal-based Afro-electro artist Kizaba. You can find his latest album, Nzela, and more of his music on SoundCloud, and follow him on Instagram, at Kizaba.
We are currently approaching Earth's orbit. Slowly. I can see the world. I can see the world.
And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes myself, Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Salmadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514 448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram. We're at Off the Hour. Or connect with us on Facebook. Just search CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe coming up next on CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
I, an episode of Junga, Ulume June 22, 2021, Amalo, Nipibumu, Tungasuvici. Ulume, Tina Pesute, Ohalamahatahalangayo, Ovanet, an episode, Amalo, Zipora Nakasa, Hano, Inuit, Picotahasum Mangata, Hanolo, Tukisivalega Hasum Mangata, Inuit, Picosing in Nehan, Inuchiavo Neomitano. Tunga to teach a hatter near Mitsano. Amalo, net out in it in the two to need to say hatteranga medusi. So Nala to inarity. I'm Annie Pisuti. Today is June 22, 2021. Welcome to Nipiwood. Today, Tina Pisuti speaks with me, Annie Pisuti, and Zipporah Nakasa about the role of elders, what it means to be an elder, and generational differences. We also play Inuktitut music, so keep on listening.